Good morning to you all, and greetings in Christ's name. Wendell and Sarah, it's good to see you all here with us as well. And I hope God's Spirit can continue to work in us and through us as he has already this morning. One summer afternoon, I was sent back up to our house where my grandparents are currently living with our Ford Escort. As a 9 or 10-year-old, I loved driving that green car. And I was tasked with picking up something for my dad and delivering it back to him. And as I pulled up to our garage, I noticed some blackbirds at our feet are off to my left. And I craned my neck around to get a better look at them. And I found myself and the car both entering the garage via a brick post at a rate of speed not recommended in those spaces. Once I removed my foot from the accelerator and gently eased it onto the brake, actually it was more of a stomp, the car paused its flight, mid-flight, toward the back wall of the garage. I sat in the car with a cracked windshield, and I knew I needed to call my dad. What would he say now that I had taken out a brick post, scraped up the freezer, ruined a garage door, and scratched the paint on the car? I went to the house and called him on our house phone, and yes, we used to have those. And you know, I don't remember the conversation. I don't remember what he said, but I do remember how I felt, how he made me feel. It was okay. Sure, we had damage and cleanup, but he never got angry or thought I was stupid. That was my dad. And over the years, I've learned a lot from him, and I've grown to respect and appreciate him more. So, thanks, Dad. Today is Father's Day, and a day that Nixon signed into a national holiday in 1972. And while it's definitely not a church holiday, I think it's an appropriate time for us to recognize the gift and influence of fathers. It's also a time to challenge men and fathers to consider their own lives and the direction and influence they're having on their family and the greater world. And as I launch into a sermon on fatherhood today, I recognize several things. One, some of us may carry baggage in our relationships with our dads. Talking about fatherhood may bring up disappointment and pain. And so I want to be careful and compassionate. And maybe it's helpful even now to think about who you can talk to about these things, and jot them down as we go along. I also recognize that some of us men are not fathers. Whether or not we've wanted to be, not all of us have children or are married, and that's a loss to grieve. I'm also thankful that all of you are not fathers. And while this sermon is directed toward fathers, I think the ideas we'll look at today are important for every parent and every individual, male or female, young and old, and they're important to wrestle with. I also want to say that some of you have raised children and faced challenging circumstances, and I want to acknowledge that. And as you reflect today, I don't want you to relive the regret, but maybe there's ways to find deeper healing. The sermon title today is A Father's Love, and I'd like to look at two characters and their stories, one in the Old Testament, one in the New Testament. And we're going to move through some scriptures, so I hope you can follow along. Let's begin by looking at Genesis 25. And we're going to read a couple of verses here. Genesis 25, starting in verse 21. This is the beginning story of Jacob, and I want to point out that the texts we're going to read here are not necessarily prescriptive, as in this is the best way to have family relationships, but more descriptive. This tells us something about how relationships work, and most importantly, who God is. It's history, and I think we can learn some important lessons from it. So this is Genesis 25. We'll start in verse 21. Let's stand as I read. Beginning in verse 21. So Isaac just got married to Rebekah, and Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it be so, why am I thus?" And she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said unto her, "Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger." And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red, all over like an hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And after that came his brother out, and his hand took hold on Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 80 years old when she bare them. And the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau, because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And Jacob sawed pottage, or made food, and Esau came from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint." Therefore was his name called Edom. And Jacob said, "Sell me this day thy birthright." And Esau said, "Behold, I am at the point to die, and what profit shall this birthright do to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me this day," and he sware unto him. And he sold his birthright unto Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink, and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Please have a seat. This is the beginning of the life of Jacob. And there's several things I'd like to note in this passage. First of all, Rebekah is carrying twins, and they struggled within her. And the Hebrew word here that is used to describe struggled has the idea to mistreat, oppress, shatter, smash, strike, smite, or strike down. So clearly this struggle is more than just normal baby movement. And when Rebekah despairs and she asks God, "Why is this happening to me?" she's told that she's giving birth to two nations. And this sets up the themes and the storyline for the rest of the book of Genesis. The enmity between Jacob and Esau. And we see this interplay between these two sons and nations throughout the rest of Genesis. And when they're born, Esau is first, and Jacob comes out grabbing his heel. And there's some fascinating wordplay here in the names they're given. You can ask me later about Esau's. We don't have time to go into that. But Jacob's name means heel grabber, or he takes by the heel. It's possible that the name, because it is derived from a verb, also means "may he protect," as in a rear guard on the heels, offering protection. So this name is given to Jacob because he came out grasping his heel, this strange birth story. But we notice almost immediately there's this division in the parenting. Isaac loves Esau, Rebekah loves Jacob. This is problematic from the beginning and is a symptom, I think, of a deeper issue that we don't read about. And this conflict in the family between Isaac and Rebekah and Jacob and Esau is highlighted in the selling of this birthright. Jacob is depicted as this even-keeled man, and Esau as this brash, hungering animal. The words he uses, "feed me, I pray thee," the word here for feed, is used later in reference to an animal eating feed, as if he's this hungering animal. Both brothers are to blame in the selling of this birthright. Esau, he sells it for food, and Jacob just drives a hard bargain. Let's jump over to chapter 27, where we'll pick up more of this story. Isaac has just told Esau to go get him some fresh venison, and he's going to receive the final blessing as his oldest son. And let's pick up in verse 5 of chapter 27. And Rebekah heard when Isaac spake to Esau his son. And Esau went to the field to hunt for venison and to bring it. This is verse 6. And Rebekah spake unto Jacob her son, saying, "Behold, I heard thy father speak unto Esau thy brother, saying, bring me venison and make me savory meat, that I may eat and bless thee before the Lord before my death. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice according to that which I command thee. Go now to the flock and fetch me from thence 2 good kids of the goats, and I will make them as savory meat for thy father, such as he loveth. And thou shalt bring it to thy father that he may eat, and that he may bless thee before his death." And Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Behold, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. My father peradventure will feel me, and I shall seem to him as a deceiver, and I shall bring a curse upon me, and not a blessing." And his mother said unto him, "Upon me be thy curse, my son. Only obey my voice, and go fetch me them." And he went and fetched, and brought them to his mother. And his mother made savory meat such as his father loved. And Rebekah took goodly raiment of her eldest son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them upon Jacob, her younger son. And she put the skins of the kids of the goats upon his hands and upon the smooth of his neck. And she gave the savory meat and the bread which she had prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. And he came unto his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here am I. Who art thou, my son?" And Jacob said unto his father, "I am Esau, thy firstborn. I have done according as thou badest me. Arise, I pray thee, sit and eat of my venison, that thy soul may bless me." And Isaac said unto his son, "How is it that thou hast found it so quickly, my son?" And he said, "Because the Lord thy God brought it to me." And Isaac said unto Jacob, "Come near, I pray thee, that I may feel thee, my son, whether thou be my very son Esau or not." And Jacob went near unto Isaac his father, and he felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." And he discerned him not, because his hands were hairy as his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. And he said, "Art thou my very son Esau?" And he said, "I am." And he said, "Bring it near to me, and I will eat of my son's venison, that my soul may bless thee." And he brought it near to him, and he did eat. And he brought him wine, and he drank. And his father Isaac said unto him, "Come near now, and kiss me, my son." And he came near and kissed him. And he smelled the smell of his raiment and blessed him and said, and we'll stop there. He goes on to bless him in the next couple of verses. The plot thickens between these brothers, and there's more issues. Rebekah eavesdrops on this conversation, and you get the idea that there's just this undermining of trust already in the marriage. She plans to subvert Isaac's blessing. She schemes a method and gets Jacob as the accomplice. I don't know what motivated her to do this, but it highlights a serious breakdown in the marriage. And even when it seems that Jacob protests, he says, "I'm smooth and he's hairy and I'll be cursed." She makes this very strong statement. She says, "I'll take the curse. Just obey me." I don't think she knew what she was asking, but it shows you the level of brokenness in the relationship and in that home. So Jacob comes to Isaac, and the lying begins. Let me just point out a couple of places. In verse 19, he lies once about his identity and the meat. He calls it venison. In verse 20, he lies about how he found the meat so quickly. Then he lies again in verse 24. About his identity. He says, in response to the question, "Are you Esau?" He says, "I am." And then he lies one more time when he kisses his father, Isaac. A kiss is an intimate gesture of charity. This was a kiss of betrayal. And Jacob gets the blessing just in time. Esau comes back, and we read the rest of this in this chapter, and he's distraught when he discovers this trick. He cried with a great and exceeding bitter cry. And notice what he says about Jacob in verse 36. He says this, "Is not he rightly named Jacob? For he hath supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he hath taken away my blessing. Hast thou not reserved a blessing for me?" The New English translation reads this same verse as, "Esau exclaimed, 'Jacob is the right name for him. He has tripped me up two times. He took away my birthright, and now, look, he's taken away my blessing.'" And it comes back to this ironic wordplay on Jacob's name. Instead of being a rear guard or a protector, Jacob trips up Esau by the heel. Essentially a deceiver. And some would suggest that it's here where Jacob's name actually takes on a negative connotation. And it's from this point out in the story that it spirals downward. Jacob runs for his life, we read later, and Esau and Isaac and Rebekah just kind of fade away from the story. And on that run for his life from his brother, in the confusion and the chaos that I'm sure Jacob was experiencing, he meets God at Luz, in a strange dream of a ladder going up from earth to heaven, with God at the top and these angels ascending and descending on the ladder. Let's turn there in chapter 28 and look how Jacob responds to this dream, this promise of God's faithfulness to him. Let's jump in the story at verses 16 and 17. We'll start there. So he's had this dream, he's been sleeping, and Jacob awaked out of his sleep, and he said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not." And he was afraid and said, "How dreadful is this place? This is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." Let's jump on down to verse 20. And Jacob vowed a vow, saying, "If God will be with me, and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread that I to eat and raiment to put on, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. And this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give the tenth unto thee." If God will be with me, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord be my God. I don't know how that strikes you, but to me it's as if Jacob is acknowledging that he's been doing a lot of running and that he's admitting his need to trust and surrender to God. "I'll make you my God." And I can't help but imagine the pain, the chaos, and the turmoil that Jacob has dealt with, seeing and hearing the friction in his parents, knowing the hatred of his brother, feeling the shame of the lies he's told and believed about himself. This man has some baggage to deal with, and God meets him here. Well, we know the rest of the story. Jacob heads to Haran, where it's love at first sight for Jacob. He settles into the farming routine for the next 7 years, all the while madly in love with Rachel, so that it seemed unto him but a few days, as Genesis says. Things seem to be settling into a less chaotic rhythm, from running from his brother to settling into farming. But when this marriage happens that he's been promised, to Jacob's surprise, he has been the one who is tripped up. Leah is his new wife, not Rachel. And in the aftermath of that confusion, Laban convinces Jacob to work another 7 years, and he gives him Rachel as his wife. But even then, family trouble continues to dog his footsteps. Now his wives are envious of each other over children, and it becomes a way to kind of lord it over each other. When Rachel blames Jacob for not giving her children, this is in chapter 30, verse 2, we read this: "And Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said, 'Am I in God's stead, who hath withheld from thee the fruit of the womb?'" You can hear him vent this same frustration that has plagued him throughout his entire life. And in the middle of the chaos in his own family now, the farm gets divided between Jacob and Laban. And I think we should pause that even in this kind of chaotic story, God continues to bless Jacob. His flock continues to increase. So the farm is divided, Jacob's flock is growing, and eventually gets to Laban's head, and Jacob sees that. More family animosity. But God tells Jacob to head back home. The leaving is messy, with Laban blaming Jacob for stealing and running off without a proper goodbye. But you can't really blame Jacob, because it's what he's done before. He's run. He's run from his problems. Eventually, Laban and Jacob make a covenant, and then they split. And it's soon after this, on his way back home, that Jacob gets the word that his older brother, who he hasn't seen for 14 years, is heading his way with 400 men. Jacob ran for his life the last time they met. And you can feel the intensity of this story mounting. This is the unresolved conflict coming to a head. This is a story of deceit coming full circle. Jacob is trapped, and he knows it. He's been tripped up by his own heel grabbing. Instead of meeting Esau that night, he meets God and spends the night wrestling with him. I think this is symbolic of all the heel grabbing and running that Jacob has ever done. He comes face to face with his own weakness and has to stare it in the face. And Jacob comes out of that night of wrestling with a new name, essentially a new identity and a new limp. He's unable to run anymore. His new name means he strives with God, or God strives. No longer is Jacob wrestling with or tripping up people, but now he wrestles with God. And I believe that even though God met Jacob previously, that this was a final surrendering or deepening of faith that happened here for him. But even then, Jacob's story is complicated after this point. He meets Esau, and then he settles near Shechem, but the family issues aren't finished. His daughter is sexually assaulted, and his brothers retaliate by killing off the men of the city. And even as Jacob gets older, you catch these whiffs of family problems. Let's turn to Genesis 37. Genesis 37, we'll read two verses here, 3 and 4. Now Israel, it's his new name, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age and he made him a coat of many colors. When his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. It's the same old family friction. Joseph, we know, is sold into slavery, kind of gone forever. That's a loss in the family, but there's more trouble. Judah has an affair with Tamar. There's a severe famine in the land for years. And then suddenly, in this miraculous turn of events, Joseph shows back up again in Egypt as second in command. And it's not until the entire family moves to Egypt and is together in Goshen that there seems to be some settledness in this family drama. In a beautiful picture at the end of his life, Jacob, the heel grabber turned God wrestler, gathers his 12 sons around him. This is towards the end of Genesis. What a fitting picture for a chaotic, divisive family to come together as a unit. That's reconciliation. And we read, funny enough, in Hebrews 11, verse 21, we read this about Jacob. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed both the sons of Joseph, his grandsons, and worshipped, leaning upon the top of his staff. Jacob, who started out struggling in the womb, spent much of his life manipulating and struggling against others who also met God face to face, blesses his grandchildren at the end of his life. And he's listed in the Hall of Fame of Faith. And throughout the Old Testament, his name is now attached to God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What a testimony to God's mercy and goodness, but what a saga of the complexities of being a parent and a father. What are some lessons we can learn from this? I have four. First of all, God is a God of redemption and reconciliation. God is a God of redemption and reconciliation. There's moments in this story, and even in our own story, where it seems that it just couldn't get worse. And yet, God continues to show up in the difficulties of Jacob's struggle and bring about good through the sin and brokenness. That's who God is. And he intends to bring wholeness to all areas of our lives in our stories today. So God is a God of redemption. We also learn that Jacob's challenges as a son carried over into his fatherhood. We already read that Isaac loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And then we read that Israel loved Joseph more than all his children. It's this favoritism that ran in the family. And I think it's important for us to recognize as parents that the very challenges we've grown up with as a son or a daughter will impact our parenting. The ways we deal with conflict before will influence the ways we deal with conflict now. The ways we've been taught to regulate our emotions as a child or not, will impact us as parents today. So our challenges as children will carry over into our parenthood. Thirdly, Jacob had to face his past. It was in the moments just before facing his rival brother, which you could say is symbolic of all his troubled past, that he wrestled with God and said these words, "I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." In a sense, he's acknowledging his past and God working through it. Whether we like it or not, we are formed by our upbringing and our past. And the older I get and the more people I work with, the more I realize how much of our perception of church, of God, of our worldview is shaped directly by our parents and or our past. I think it's okay if it terrifies us a little bit. It should cause all of us, not just as fathers or parents, but anyone who has influence, to consider seriously the way our life and our choices are shaping others. Jacob had to face his past. And finally, he also had to come to peace with himself first. As I read over Jacob's story and was in preparation for this, one of the things that jumped out to me was all the unresolved conflict that Jacob carried with him into his adult life. And I'm not suggesting that we sit around and analyze all the details of our childhood and excuse our current behavior because of it, but I think we need to recognize the stumbling block that unresolved tension or conflict and hurt in our relationships can actually be. And as fathers and parents, we're called to bear God's image to our children. And unless we understand forgiveness and what it means to be at peace with God and ourselves, we cannot extend that forgiveness to others or to our children. If performance drives my relationship with God, or is the way I measure myself, then it will drive my relationship with my children. If I don't understand God's unconditional love for me right now, then I will have difficulty knowing how to love my children well. If I'm not settled in my calling, in God's calling for my life, then I will struggle to raise settled children. If I'm not actively growing in my walk with Christ, then it will be difficult for me to help my children grow in Christ. I think we have the hardest time forgiving ourselves. And I think that trips us up more than we realize. And sometimes our children bear the brunt of that. Our parenting must come out of a place of love, rest, and peace with God and ourselves. And that brings us to the second story. Let's turn to Luke 15. Luke 15. This is one of Jesus' well-known parables. I'm going to start in verse 11 and read through the end of the chapter, and I'll ask you to stand again. Luke 15, verse 11 to the end. And he said, this is Jesus speaking, "A certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me.' And he divided unto them his living. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country, and there wasted his substance with riotous living. And when he had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in that land, and he began to be in want. And he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would fain have filled his belly with the husks that the swine did eat, and no man gave unto him. And when he came to himself, he said, 'How many hired servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and will say unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants.' And he arose and came to his father. But when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said unto him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and am no more worthy to be called thy son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring forth the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring hither the fatted calf and kill it. Let us eat and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to be merry. Now, his elder son was in the field, and as he came and drew nigh to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said unto him, 'Thy brother is come, and thy father hath killed the fatted calf, because he hath received him safe and sound.' And he was angry, and would not go in. Therefore came his father out and entreated him. And he answering said to his father, 'Lo, these many years do I serve thee, neither transgressed I at any time thy commandment, and yet thou never gavest me a kid that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this thy son was come, which hath devoured thy living with harlots, thou hast killed for him the fatted calf.' And he said unto him, 'Son, Thou art ever with me, and all that I have is thine. It was meet that we should make merry and be glad, for this thy brother was dead, and is alive again, and was lost, and is found. Please have a seat. It seems, if we look at the context of this story, that Jesus is using this story to speak to the Pharisees and the tax collectors, or sinners. And this story has all the elements of family drama. An annoying, wasteful little brother, a controlling older sibling, and a dad who's just kind of out of touch with reality. But before we get hung up on these details, I want us to consider the bigger point of this story. We often call this the parable of the prodigal, as if he is the main character. And while it is about repentant sinners, I would suggest that this is the parable of the Father's love. The climax of this story is the response of both the father and the older brother. Let's take a look at these characters in turn. The younger son, who rightfully could inherit a third of his father's estate or half his older brother's inheritance, seems to be impulsive. He demands his share of property, leaves home, and going to a far country here might not indicate physical distance as much as just alienation from the family. And he just spends it all. And the Greek word that is translated as wasted in the KJV literally means a scattering or dispersing of seeds. I get the picture of throwing it to the wind. It really was a waste. And then the son stoops even lower and ends up not just being hired by a Gentile, but working as a pig farmer. This is about as low as you can get. It's completely antithetical to being Jewish. One of the distinguishing marks for the Israelites that God commanded them not to do is to eat pork, much less raise pigs. Everyone in his life is gone. From the audience's perspective, this guy just needs to be cut off. He's a goner. The older brother is faithful. He watches the interchange between dad and his younger brother, and I can imagine as he's working the fields, this resentment is building. Seriously, this brother of mine is a jerk. He's already kind of cut his younger brother off from the family in his own mind. This brother's got the good life. He has all the time with dad that he wants. And father is not a wimpy dad that is out of touch with reality like we might think. He doesn't demand much of his son, and he gives in to his son's wishes for his inheritance, but he is wise and he is patient. And most of all, there's a deep love for his son. He's a dad who loves. Think about it. Who does this wayward son think of when he's at the bottom? It's dad. Who does he think of being merciful to servants? It's dad. Who does he plan to go back to when he returns home? It's dad. Dad is a dad who loves. And somehow, it seems that he's communicated this to his lost son. So we read, lost son realizes that not only has he sinned against dad, but also heaven or God himself. I'm willing to take a lower place in the family just to be back in dad's presence. He prepares his speech and heads home, probably walking head down with shame. Dad sees his son a long way off. This is the moment he was waiting for. While the son walks, dad runs. That's redemption. While the sinner walks, God runs. And dad ran, which in this culture would seem a little bit immature or unseemly for an older man to run. And he fell on his neck. That's a Hebrew idiom for a bear hug today. And he kisses him. A deliberate sign of affection that I think could be noted as, we're at peace. I still love you. It's this intense display of emotion and welcome. Son tries to give his speech, but dad just cuts him off and gets into party mode. This is a full-on celebration, and Jesus is making the point that this is to be joyful. Let us eat and be merry, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. My son has come back home, and it's not just physically present, but he is being reinstated as my son. The oldest son finds out about this. He doesn't even want to get close. He asks the servant about it, and dad has to come out to meet him just like he did with his lost son. The same father, with the same love, comes out and implores the older son to join in festivities and welcome his younger brother back as a brother. And the older brother just gives vent to the frustration and resentment from the previous years and doesn't even acknowledge the lost son as his brother. He's been cut off. He calls him, "This thy son who hangs out with prostitutes," to dad's face. You can imagine the contempt dripping in his voice. It seems that this son has the biggest problem with dad's reckless love. Why are you throwing a party for a son who's disgraced you? Why are you wasting your resources on a son who has wasted a third of our inheritance? Why do you love him? And here's the striking image. The son who is reckless with his identity and his wealth as a son is welcomed home by the dad who is reckless with his love. And the older son just can't stomach it. He disengages, justifies his resentment, judges from a distance, and walks away. Both sons were undone by the father's generous love. Both sons, the oldest and the youngest, were undone by the father's generous love. At one level, this is a story justifying Jesus' actions. We read at the beginning of the chapter, being with sinners to the Pharisees. At another level, this is a story of God, his love for us and his pursuit of us. At another level, this is a call for all fathers and parents. I think there are several key points that we can notice from this story, and they're all centered around this father's love. I have five of them. Love maintains relationship. Love maintains relationship. Every relationship or connection that you have with your children continues to give opportunity for growth and redemption. When we're annoyed or hurt by our children, it can feel easy just to want to give them what they deserve. Cutting off relationship, though, removes the opportunity for you as a parent to be the tangible means of God's redemption and love in your child's life. By cutting off relationship with his younger brother, the older brother was not the means to his redemption. We have to recognize that some of our deepest pain is that of strained relationships in our family. And as fathers and parents, we need to be able to bear some of that pain without taking it out on our children. Love doesn't gloss over the challenges or ignore the potential hurt in family relationships. It acknowledges all of it and still chooses to walk forward to that son. It still chooses to walk forward into that relationship with openness. I can't imagine the pain and humiliation that this father felt as he ran towards his son. He ran towards both of his sons. So love maintains relationship. Love also listens. One of the easiest things to slip out of our mouths and our actions is, "I told you so," or "Stop it. How could you do that?" It's easier to talk at our children rather than ask questions and listen. Children need to be heard. And of course, there are times where children need discipline or consequences without opportunity for them to explain themselves. But as children grow older and begin to think for themselves, you will need to give them opportunities for conversations around their choices, etc. And this takes a lot of hard work. But conversation and communication is one of the mediums of healthy relationships. Ask questions in a curious, calm way that'll disarm and diffuse a potentially volatile situation. Tone matters just as much as words. Seek to understand before you seek to be understood. So love listens. Love is also slow. Often our children's choices and actions become part of our identity. When a child disregards my values, it's easy for us to call into question everything about ourselves and who we are. What have I done with my life? The other temptation is for us to rush to solutions to fix the problems. And humans, especially your own children, are pretty good at picking up when they are viewed as projects or simply trying to be fixed. But love has long, slow-form redemption in mind. Love builds a relationship, not a solution. We must give it time and patiently wait for God to redeem. After all, it took Jacob an entire lifetime for his redemption. So love is slow. Love also recognizes our own mistakes. And it takes a posture of humility, recognizing our own mistakes and shortcomings. And Jesus mentions this idea in Matthew 7, where he says, we have this ludicrous picture of someone trying to dig out a tiny speck in somebody's eye with this gigantic log sticking out of their own. The message is clear. Love checks for logs in our own eyes first. And often the logs in our eyes involve the motivations of our heart. So we should ask, what is driving my response to my child? I need to analyze my motivations before I can help them. So love recognizes our own mistakes. And then finally, love is tenacious. And this is shown in God's own love for us. Paul writes in Romans 5:8, but God commended his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. It's this idea that even while we were still running away, not even realizing our own sinfulness, God was demonstrating his love toward us by giving us his son for salvation. That's what love does. It's annoyingly insistent. It doesn't make the person annoying, but it consistently beckons an individual toward the lover. That's the kind of parents we're called to be, tenacious lovers. And it's my love for my child that is anchored in God's love for me. Love is tenacious. So where does that leave us? We've seen the effects of unresolved conflict in Jacob's life and the pain that caused in resulting generations. We've also seen the father's love for us and as an example to us for our children. I'd like to consider two questions here at the end. As fathers, parents, young people, even children, what are the areas of unresolved conflict? What are the areas of unresolved conflict or pain that you're carrying? What are the places of regret and shame in your family relationships that you need to surrender? Or what are the shortcomings in your life that you need to face? Have you forgiven yourself, your parents, or your own children? Have you wrestled with God recently? And secondly, am I experiencing God's welcoming, abundant, tenacious love in my life as a current reality? And then, am I loving my children with the same welcoming, abundant, tenacious love? Parenting is farming. We're called to be faithful in our seed sowing and relationship building, not force the growth. And it's an act of faith that God will bring about the fruit, the redemption, and the reconciliation. Let's kneel for prayer. Father, I ask that your Spirit would speak to us. That you'd reveal to us the areas of unresolved conflict, the places of pain that we've been hiding or unable to push into. I ask that you would meet us in our need, in the challenges we face. Help us to offer forgiveness. Help us to forgive ourselves, our parents, and our children. I ask that there could be reconciliation in the challenging relationships in this very room. I ask that your Spirit work a work of love, of redemption and wholeness
in each of us, in the most challenging and painful relationships of our own families. Give parents courage and strength and wisdom as they continue to be faithful in the seed sowing. Bless each of the fathers here and give them courage and humility to admit mistakes and to continue to learn and grow and to be more like you and offer Father's love. Thank you for your Spirit at work here in us, and we ask all these things in your name. Amen.